Hey guys, it's your host Julian. This week I'm sitting down and chatting with Donovan Cook, creator of one of my favorite cartoons of all time, Two Stupid Dogs. I want to give a special shout out to a couple of our patrons that helped make this podcast possible. Bill, Brent, Brittany, Call Me Spikey, Eight-Legged Bird, Jacob, and Nick. Thank you all so much for your support. It truly means a lot. If you want to become a patron and help support this show, check the show notes below and sign up today. Now, let's get on to my chat with Donovan. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to What's My Head Podcast. My name is Julian. Today I'm joined by Donovan. Donovan, man, long time coming. Welcome to the show.
Howdy.
Man, it's a pleasure to have you. We did a little bit of chat before we hit record, and I got to tell you just how special Two Stupid Dogs were to me and my brother. You know, you kept my mom from pulling out a lot of her hair because her two sons were fighting when this show came on, complete ceasefire. So I would love to know, how does Donovan come up with Two Stupid Dogs? Where does this creation enter you?
You want the short version or the long version?
Whichever one you want to tell. I love stories, so go for it.
The long version is graduated from school, Cal Arts in 90, and went to Disney Features. In the year that I spent at Disney Features after school, started to really feel like, oh man, you know, it's really easy to just kind of slip into the industry and become kind of a cog in the wheel. And I really felt like I didn't want me and all my friends from school to stop making our own stuff and to stop, you know, experimenting and trying to break the rules. And so, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 months after we'd gotten out of school, I called a handful of friends and said, hey, let's have dinner. It was, you know who Ash Brannon is?
I don't.
He co-directed Pixar, Toy Story 2 up at Pixar. Ash Brannon, Chris Ure, who's been at Disney Features as a monster in the story department for years now. Same with Mark Kennedy. And Barry Johnson, who's, I think, been at Pixar for many, many years now. It was those four guys. We were all in school together. We met at a place up in Valencia, which is where Cal Arts is. We all used to go to dinner at this place called the Alamo. It's a Mexican restaurant that's actually still there, believe it or not. So this was in 1990. So we got together and I pitched all of them like, hey, let's make a cartoon, you guys. You know, just us, just for screwing around, just to have fun and keep making our own stuff. And so we all brainstormed a whole bunch of different ideas for cartoons, and I wrote them all down. And one of them was two really stupid dogs. And so we broke away, and I spent some time with that list, and that was the one thing that like I circled, and I couldn't let it go. So I came up with a little bit of material for it, and then I called the group back together and said, let's make this cartoon. And we spent a few months working on it. And then because everybody was out of school and most of them were working, they were too busy. And so that group kind of slipped away, but I loved it. And I loved what we had done. Chris Ure had done a bunch of amazing designs as well as Barry Johnson. And so I couldn't let it go. So, I don't know however many months later we had another dinner and I, you know, we had kind of a little handshake deal where I can't remember. I think I paid him all a tiny bit of cash to buy him out of the idea. And then I went and a friend of mine had just gotten an agent because they were starting to pitch some ideas. So I pitched what I had to a couple of agents that were kind of in the animation biz. And they gave me some good feedback to turn it into a little bit bigger pitch. And at this time, I wasn't pitching it as a series. I was pitching it. I wanted to make theatrical shorts, which nobody was making, and there was nobody willing to spend any money on it. But I pitched it around town. I pitched it at Fox, a couple other places that would take the pitch for short cartoons. And then these agents were like, "All right, if you really want to make this, you gotta turn the pitch into a series pitch." And so they gave me a little bit more feedback about how to do that, and I went away, you know, for a few more weeks, and you know, spent, you know, all-nighters working on it, doing some more artwork, and fleshing out sort of a beatboard storyboard that that I think Chris Ure had done for the pilot, and built it into a pitch that I could take out to the studios. And we took it everywhere. I was only the only place we didn't pitch it was Disney, but we pitched it everywhere. We pitched it to Warner Brothers, to Fox, to every independent studio, and like the second to last place we pitched it was Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah.
Because and nobody was, almost nobody was making shorts at that time. Nickelodeon was getting, they were getting off the ground, and like I think John was. His Ren and Stimpy's were mostly short format, although some of them I think were like 11s and some of them were 7s. It was kind of all over the place. But those weren't, it hadn't even aired yet. Like Nickelodeon hadn't even dropped any of that stuff yet, I don't think, when we were pitching it. But Hanna-Barbera was, at the time, they were making Tom and Jerry kids short cartoons, and it was just the same old standard, you know, 3 7-minute cartoons makes a half hour. So they totally got it. Everybody else looked at me like I was crazy. Like, how do you make a series out of this? And it was kind of like, didn't we all just spend our entire youth growing up watching 3 Warner Brothers cartoons make a half hour of television? Like, it was weird. Nobody got it, but Hanna-Barbera got it, and they thought it was funny. So we started making a deal, which is, I mean, it's incredible because I was a baby. I mean, I was 22 years old, I think, when I pitched it to him.
What was so endearing about wanting to stick to it? Now, I've had so many people that have pitched this, and I just had Alex Kerwin on a couple nights ago, and we talked just nothing but Looney Tunes, the new Looney Tunes show that he did a couple years back. And almost every person I've had on, they bring up the Looney Tunes. So was it just that homage to the Looney Tunes that you all grew up on that you wanted to stick with those theatrical shorts, or just stick it to a shorts program?
It's a, short cartoons are funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? It's that, you know, nowadays you can go anywhere from like 2 minutes to 11 minutes and it's still that short cartoon format, but mm-hmm. That 7 minute short cartoon, it's like the perfect genre for being funny in the cartoon sensibility. It's just short enough. It's just long enough that you can actually tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end. And it's short enough that you can be as stupid and crazy and nuts as you want to be. And it just fits. There's just something really organic about that short format for being, you know, just wildly funny.
Absolutely. Now, when you said you pitched it to almost everybody with the exception of Disney, does any, before we get to you pitching and then Hanna-Barbera, you know, signing off on it and wanting to take that and take it to series, did any of those pitches seem like anybody else was interested, or was it like you knew once you went out there, like, oh, they're not going to get this?
No. There were a couple. I had a couple of nibbles. Like Fox was making, I think, Eek the Cat at the time. And that's that sensibility was pretty funny. So they gave a half a look at it. But they were kind of weirded out by just, oh, you're just gonna make 3 shorts and whatever. Like, they didn't quite get that. The closest I came to selling it before Hanna-Barbera was the team that was getting ready to do I guess Animaniacs, because Animaniacs was anthology with all sorts of different length cartoons. Mm-hmm. And you know, they had different segments and different characters. And so they definitely talked to me about it, you know, more than once, because I think they thought it might fit into their format. I don't remember why they didn't buy it, but maybe because I was 22.
Was when you're going around and you're pitching this around town, you know, you brought up your age a couple times, and I do think that it's something that it's never spoken about enough, like how young you guys are when you guys not only enter the industry, but you guys are out there pitching shows that changed a lot of our lives. You know, and before we hit record, I told you, without your show, without SWAT Cats, without Space Ghost Coast to Coast, In my humble opinion, there's no such thing as Cartoon Network. You guys laid the groundwork. You guys walked so everything else that came after could run. You know, you guys really propped up that network. I don't give a shit what anybody says. It doesn't matter who it is. I don't care what anybody says. You guys laid the groundwork for that network. You laid the infrastructure. You know, with that being said, what's it like? I know this is a long time ago. This is 32 years ago now at this point. What was it like? Do you remember anything about pitching? Do you remember anything about going into there? What was your mindset like? Did it seem real? Was it surreal? What was going on through Donovan's head?
To even put it together and go out there and basically ask people to let you make your own TV series. I mean, for better or for worse, I was pretty arrogant at the time. I mean, so while I didn't know what I was doing, I believed I knew how to do it all. Mm-hmm. I would go into the office or the conference room, you know, filled with confidence. Every time I walked into the room, I figured these guys are definitely going to buy it.
Yeah.
This is the place. And, you know, the first pitches were really shitty, but I practiced it like crazy. Mm-hmm. So that I knew it really well and I could control the timing, particularly of the board pitch. I was really confident and you know, persistent, stupid, whatever you want to call it. To me, it wasn't crazy that I would sell the show somewhere and make it. I mean, that to me, it was like, well, what else would happen? The idea that somebody wouldn't buy it and that I wouldn't make it somewhere was not even in the ether for me.
Yeah. I mean, as it should be. I mean, you're only going to nobody's going to promote you the way you promote yourself. Nobody is going to be your biggest fan or your biggest critic. I mean, I said all the time, nobody can say anything about me that I haven't said about myself that's 10 times worse than I know how to cut deep. You know what I mean? You know, so when you're going in there and doing that, first off, when you go to school for animation at CalArts in particular, you know, do they show you how to pitch things to networks, or are you just pitching in front of your friends, or how does that whole process work? How do you figure out how to pitch?
I mean, especially at CalArts in the late 80s, you know, everything's a little different now, but it's that program was designed by and still taught primarily by Disney feature people. Mm-hmm. So it was a program that taught you, it wasn't like a filmmaker's program. It taught you how to animate and primarily how to animate very traditionally. And so the pitching that you learned, like my class, we were exceedingly fortunate in that we had a year or 2 years, our story teacher was Joe Ramft, mm-hmm. Who's a legend. At the time, he was just Joe Ramft, but he was amazing. But so he taught us how to pitch a storyboard, but that's different than pitch a whole concept for a movie or pitch an idea for a series. So no, CalArts, the system there didn't teach you how to pitch like to executives or anything like that at all. No, I mean, that's partly why. There's two reasons why at least I needed agents. One was I didn't know anybody, like who the hell would I pitch to?
Yeah.
This was, again, I mean, we're talking about, you know, 91, 92. There's no, you know, there's none of the stuff that exists today where you can find people and, mm-hmm. you know, there were books you could buy that had like, here's the listing of all the executives at all the studios. You know, so you could probably get that book and maybe cold call some people and try to get some pitches. But without an agent back then, you just didn't even know who to, you know, you didn't know who to call, where to go, especially if you weren't, I mean, if you were just out of school, like half the places I pitched, I didn't even know they existed. Yeah. You know, if you were a veteran, if you'd already made shows, you know, you already had kind of a network, but I didn't know anybody. And they also, they knew, you know, kind of what format the pitch needed to be in. So I pitched it. I pitched it to them once. They gave me feedback. I pitched it to them again. I think I pitched it like three times to them and got notes and feedback and advice before we ever went out and did sort of our first real pitch.
Now, with I want to circle back to something you had said. You said when you're 22, so you went in there very arrogant, very full of yourself. Like, no, who's gonna pass up on this brilliant idea of these two really stupid dogs, right? When they give you notes, do you remember if you took those notes to heart? Did you really look at them? You're like, bah, these guys don't know what they're talking about.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't remember getting, I mean, nobody gives you notes. You know, they just, they, you know, they either laugh at your pitch if they're, you know, if they like cartoons. I mean, over the years, you pitch to a lot of people, and some people you're like, why are you taking pitches for cartoons? You don't think any of, you know, like, you don't laugh at anything. So, I mean, they'll laugh, they might ask you some questions. I don't remember ever getting a note like, you should do this with it. Or if it was, I mean, the only note I ever got probably was, you should make this in, you know, you should pitch this as 22 minutes. That was a note I, you know, I didn't want to hear that because I wanted to make cartoons. I wanted to make short cartoons.
Gotcha. So when, what was, do you remember that first pitch? Not the one that you sold it on, but do you remember that first pitch? What was going through your mind? Like, what were you feeling? Were you spastic? Were you wild? Were you like, oh my God, I'm doing this? Like, I got to imagine everybody remembers their first, so.
The first pitch for it as a series, I think, was at Fox Animation, because I think the agents felt like that's probably the most likely place to buy this weird idea.
Just because of The Simpsons and Eek the Cat.
Primarily because of Eek the Cat, and because, again, if you could teleport yourself back to 1992 or 91 when I was pitching it. The idea of a TV show called Two Stupid Dogs. I mean, people weren't saying that word on TV like that. I mean, like, and the fact that it was the title of the show. I mean, that, like, my first, you know, like, first board of the pitch was Two Stupid Dogs, and a lot of people would immediately be like, "What the fuck are we seeing? Like, how are we?" But the funny thing about that pitch was, again, I went in, I was really excited, and I'm sure I was super nervous too, but the funniest thing that I remember is, you know, I burned through it. You know, it was like, it was, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, you prep for it and you get your energy up, and it's like you're going out and doing like an improv set or something, you know? So you go through it, you go through it, you go through it, and then you're done. And I remember being in the elevator with the agents. And one of them turned to me and said, I can't remember the number, but it was something like, you know, 43 ums. And I was like, what? Like, what words are you speaking to me? And they had counted the number of times I said, and then this, and then the little dog does this, And so that was a big, like, a piece of critique. I was like, are you serious? I couldn't believe it. So I went home that night and I practiced the pitch. Every time I caught myself saying or something like that, I would stop, go back to the beginning, and start again. And I didn't stop until I could get through the whole thing without doing it once.
So how long do they typically give you to pitch? Is it like half hour, 15 minutes to pitch?
That's a good question. Back then, I gotta guess the pitch was like a half hour.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
Okay.
maybe probably shorter. I mean, nowadays you go in and pitch, and if you're over 15 minutes, you're probably dead. But things were a little bit fatter then. So somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes probably was the pitch.
Now, with every pitch that you went to, would you get, what's that?
Especially because I had a storyboard. You know, so I would pitch, you know, the title, the concept, the characters, the relationship. And then I would pitch a couple story premises, like, here's the kind of stories we're going to tell. And then I had a storyboard, and I would pitch, if you remember the one where they went to the drive-in, that was like a full cartoon that I pitched in the pitch for the show. That was like the pilot.
Oh,
A
wow.
little bit longer because I pitched a whole storyboard.
Got you. When you're doing the pitch, obviously you're going to a bunch of different networks. You're seeing a bunch of different executives. So the spectrum on what somebody might think is funny is pretty vast, right? So with that being said, were you getting a lot of the same laughs or a lot of the same like eye raises in the same spot with your pitch, or would you have to kind of tailor it for each different network?
Honestly, I don't remember the details. I mean, I remember that if somebody laughed at one joke, I would know, like, okay, I got two more jokes like that downstream. I'll hit those a little harder. Mm-hmm. If they didn't get, you know, some other joke, I would, you know, I would kind of let those kind of jokes go. But otherwise, I mean, it was a pitch that I had worked very hard on, and it was a, you know, I didn't ad lib and go off and invent new shit during the pitch. I mean, I mean, the show was not vague. It was very clear. This is the show. These are the characters. These are what the stories are going to be. So if somebody wasn't getting it, I would just keep going as if they were and you know, be done.
I got you. With that being said, let's flash forward just a little bit ahead. So you get picked up by Hanna-Barbera. What is that moment like when they say, "We love what you got. We want to take this to series"?
It was huge, but it's not like that.
No.
And quite frankly, it was even foggier than that, because I pitched it and it was a good pitch. And so I left with, you know, a handshake, like, I'm going to show this to, you know, the person I work for, but this seems like it might be something we'd be interested in, which was a
lot.
Who'd
you show it to?
Side story. So I showed up, I was supposed to meet with the head of development, mm-hmm. Whose name I can't remember anymore. But he was sick. So, in the little reception area at Hanna-Barbera, I was like before emails and whatever. So at the time that, you know, that your meeting was set for, there wasn't a lot of like, I'm going to confirm that morning and, you know, all the stuff that you do now. So, I showed up at the time I was supposed to show up, and they were like, oh yeah, that person's out sick today. But if you want to pitch to this person who works for them, they're available. You can do that. And I remember thinking to myself briefly, like, well, maybe I should wait and pitch it to whoever I was supposed to pitch it to. And then I was like, ah, fuck it, I'm here. I'll go pitch it to whoever. Like, I mean, to me, if you're willing to take my pitch, I'm on, you know, like. And I pitched it to a junior development executive who was a big part of, you know, getting the show bought and then producing the show, and is still my wife.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you guys hit it off right out of the gate?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's so dope.
The little sappy romantic story I like to tell is right smack in the middle of the pitch, I remember losing my focus for a minute and thinking like, yeah, I kind of like her. Shit, I gotta I'm pitching the show. So you know, the pitch went well. She liked it. She said she wanted to show it to, you know, the head of development that she worked for. And it didn't take long. They called me again probably in a couple weeks, a week or, you know, and back then getting, you know, waiting a week or two for a call was nothing. I mean, that was fast. Mm-hmm. But the crazy thing that happened is it was either the same week that I pitched it, or the next week, Turner bought Hanna-Barbera.
Oh, wow.
So boom, like the whole place blew up. So they called and said, yeah, we're interested. We like it. We think we can make it. We think we can make a cartoon out of it. But we just got bought by Turner and we have no idea what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We don't know what we're doing. So then it went into this weird stall for months, where every once in a while I would get a call asking if I could either come in and repitch it to somebody new. I did that a couple times, and then I think it was when it took forever for Turner to hire Fred. Mm-hmm. And then I think they hired Fred, and I had gotten a short-term gig working on a project in London. And so I was out of the country. And they called and wanted the material to show it to Fred. I think it was to Fred. I'm pretty sure it was to Fred. And I was like, well, I'm in London. But he was, you know, he hadn't moved to LA yet. So he was like coming into town for a short period of time. So I don't know if you know who Mark Dindal is, but Mark Dindal's old.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mark, I still lived up in up near school, up in Santa Clarita in Valencia area. And Mark lived up there too. And I remember calling Mark and I was like, I need a favor. Go to my apartment. Here's how you break in. You get this material and I need you to take it to Hanna-Barbera.
And, little B&E.
Mark was awesome. He did it. He climbed out on my balcony, broke in through my sliding glass door, got the portfolio with the pitch in it and took it down there. But so that call came and it was like, yeah, we like it. But then it was months and months and months before anything like actually solid happened. And then when they did actually say, yeah, we want to make a deal for it, it wasn't like, we're going to go to series. It was, we're going to take a look at it and do some work on it. And then there was, the other thing was Hanna-Barbera was a closed shop at that time. They would buy an idea from somebody, but they wouldn't bring in somebody new, much less a 22-year-old. So they kept coming back to me and saying, we want it.
All right, as we take a pause for the cause, if you haven't yet, you should check us out on all social media platforms by searching at In My Head Pod. There you can see who we've got coming on, and if you feel so inclined to, you could submit a question to be asked. Now, let's get back to the show.
We want to produce it in our in-house with our people. And I was like, the whole fucking reason I came up with this idea was to make cartoons and for me to learn, you know, more how to do this, to get better at this. What's the point of me just giving it to you and I can consult on it or something? I can't remember. They were offering me some kind of, you know, consulting creative something, but I wasn't going to make them. So I just kept saying no. And it was Fred that finally he told him, like, bring him in, have him meet with, at that time the head of production was Jane Barbera. Mm-hmm. And there was another old school guy that was part of her team. And I went in and had to meet with them, and they had to basically go, yeah, he can probably make it. He won't destroy it. Like he won't like burn all the money and not have a cartoon afterwards. But that was almost like a full year process, I think. A little less, but almost a year.
What was the
in the door and had an office. And then it was pretty quick from, I mean, I was in the door and they still hadn't said absolutely they were going to make 13 half hours. But it wasn't long after.
What was the thought process behind having that closed off animation studio? Was it just because of the merger or not wanting to bring people in?
I'm sure it was money. It was about making. I mean, animation. You've talked to everybody. I mean, you know, it is a laborious process with an unbelievable number of steps. And back in, you know, like, it's complicated now with all the digital stuff that's part of it, but it was complicated back then with just all the analog bits and pieces, and TV shows didn't, you know, you didn't have big budgets, especially, I mean, Hanna-Barbera back then, they were making, I mean, they did not have big budgets. So it was, I think it was about making shows cheap and fast.
Gotcha.
They had their assembly line, they had their people that they knew how to do it. And they did not want to disrupt that.
Yeah, the Hanna-Barbera, almost like Marvel, the Marvel way to draw, the Marvel way to write. I mean, Disney's got their own way of. I mean, they damn near created the guidebook, the Bible, if you will, on animation. I mean, obviously, many studios, Fleischer before then, you know, UPA. I mean, Fleischer within conjunction with Disney and all of them. You know, so everybody had their standard, everybody had their way of, you know, kind of making the sausage, if you will, or making the cartoons. Since we're talking animation. So when you come on and then you're in Hanna-Barbera, were you a fan of Hanna-Barbera? I know we had talked Looney Tunes. Okay, so you're a fan of Hanna-Barbera. What was that like?
I was Looney Tunes, and I was actually a really big fan of classic Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Disney movies and the old Disney, the classic Disney characters. But for me, I mean, I loved Flintstones, particularly Flintstones, Yogi Bear. And believe it or not, Scooby-Doo. I mean, when I was a kid, I mean, I'm talking about, I mean, I loved Scooby-Doo, but I loved Secret Squirrel.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I had, like, for me, there were a lot of Hanna-Barbera things that were important to me and were part of, you know, why I wanted to make cartoons. So it was an exciting place to be.
What was it like walking those halls at 22 years old, seeing these industry titans, these guys that you grew up on?
you know what? It was awesome, but at the same time, like I said, I had a lot of flaws back then, I have a lot of flaws now, but one of my biggest flaws back then was arrogance. I mean, I walked in there and thought, you know, me and my crew are gonna show you guys how to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, if I hadn't been so stupid and so arrogant, I'd have been embarrassed mm-hmm. by how little I reached out to get to learn from people. I mean, I learned more than I could probably tell from Larry Huber.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not, I didn't search out Larry. They put Larry, you know, on me, and because Larry was, you know, he was the only guy there that was a veteran that was willing to mix it up with these idiot, like 22, 23, 20 year old. And his, I mean, he was there to make sure we didn't blow the place up. And then, you know, slowly we all figured out that he was there to teach us how to actually do this. But we all showed up. I mean, and I, you know, I was the first one in the door from that crew. We showed up thinking that what they had been making for the past few years was garbage, mm-hmm. and that, you know, we were going to disrupt the place like crazy. And that's honestly, and that was all, you know, that's all Fred. Fred is the only reason any of us got into that place that had an infrastructure to make cartoons like no other place practically. And he let us disrupt everything and say, we don't want to do it that way. We want to do it this way. I don't want to draw that. I want to draw this. I mean, all that stuff. I mean, it was sketchy for a little while. There were some people there that were not happy. there was a little bit of, you know, I don't know, a little bit of us and them with the old veterans and, but not everybody. There were some of the artists were amazing. And honestly, I think some of us were smarter than I was, you know, some of that team were smarter than I was and reached out to guys like Ewo and Don Jurwicz and, you know, just everybody that was there and wanted to learn, you know, what they had to teach. But it was definitely a time of, we're here to take over, you guys. We're here to bring in the new guard. Which, yeah, sounds, I don't know what that sounds like, but we all just thought what they were doing wasn't funny and wasn't interesting, and we knew we could make funny and interesting cartoons.
I mean, it's just the way of the world. I mean, I know I did it. I mean, when I graduated high school, I graduated high school in 2008. And something very significant about that year was the housing market crashed. I lost my job right after high school, and I was living with my sister and my brother-in-law. And I was tired of living with them. I needed to be out. I needed to be doing something different. So I joined the military shortly after. I never wanted to do it.
Navy, right?
Yeah, I was in the Navy. I was stationed in San Diego for a little while. I was going to bring this question up at the end. Yes, when I saw your San Diego shirt, I was like, my favorite place. So my favorite place to get a burger when I was stationed in San Diego was Hodad's. It was I think they still had just the one spot on, was it Ocean Beach? They've got one in Padre Stadium now. At least the last time I was there, they had one. They had just opened up. But Hodad's favorite cheeseburger in this kind, and my body is built by cheeseburgers and bread. You know what I mean? So they got a great cheeseburger out there in San Diego. But yeah, I know I was the same way. I'm humble when I need to be, but I know my worth in anything I do. I put my head down and I'm a workhorse, right? I'm that guy that you can go to and no problem knocking out what even in the industry I work in now, in the food industry. I'm that guy that everybody goes to when they know, like, oh shit, we need some magic. They go to this guy, you know? So when I was young, I was the same way. Headstrong, arrogant. I talked a lot of shit. But I was very quick to apologize too, you know. I usually save this question towards the end, but I think it's fitting to say it now. It's because we've talked about, you know, you being so young coming in and you guys being that ragtag, that MTV like personified generation coming in and shake the establishment to the core, right? You guys were the culture shift, the culture changers, right? So if you could go back, theoretically, you can get in that DeLorean with Marty McFly or Doc Brown. You could go back to 22-year-old Donovan. What would you tell yourself? What would you tell the people that you were working with? Is there anything in particular, not so much that you would change or regret, but is there anything that you would like to have said or done differently at 22 years old?
Oh, I mean, the big thing that I don't like to call it a regret, but yeah, if I had been smart enough to listen to anybody. Like Larry probably told me to do this and I probably ignored him, but I would have spent more time asking Larry, quite frankly, how should we do what we're doing? Are we doing this right? Should we do this? There were a few people there, by the way, that I did listen to and I learned a lot from, including Larry, but Joanna Remersa, there were some veterans there that then, by the way, when I left Disney when I left Hanna-Barbera and went to Disney, I took a few, you know, old school people with me because they became really part of my crew. But the big thing that I really, really am still like, I can't believe I didn't spend more time with Bill and Joe.
Yeah.
Those guys created television animation. And before that, they made, you know, I mean, I don't know how many Oscars they won. They made some of the best short cartoons that have ever been made. And I had 3 years where I was in the same building with those guys every day. And I went and saw them a few times and I got a story that I love to tell about Joe and Secret Squirrel. But I would have definitely, if I could go back and slap, you know, 22-year-old version of myself across the face and say, do this. And then, and quite frankly, so I would include, you know, Bill and Joe would be on the top of that list, but then I would say Larry and some of his cohorts and Fred. I mean, I spent most of my time with Fred either arguing with him or saying, all right, please leave us alone now. And Fred's a brilliant guy that changed animation. And I could have learned a lot from Fred, but I didn't.
So there's two things I wanted to circle back to. But since we're talking about Fred, and we can completely skip over this if you'd like, we can delve a little bit deeper. It's completely up to you. I'm not going to push the topic. But if you could say anything to Fred right now, what would you say to him?
I would say, I mean, I don't know that I ever said thank you to Fred. I mean, I didn't show Fred enough gratitude, if I showed him any gratitude at all. I mean, I think I was so arrogant that I figured I was doing him a favor by making Two Stupid Dogs there and by bringing in an army of people funnier and better at making cartoons than I was. I filled, you know, my team with people that ended up making more cartoons there. And so if that's what I would say to Fred, I would say thank you. And I would say, you know, he changed my life and he changed animation. And I honestly, the other thing I would say is I still can't believe that, you know, for 10-ish years, that the things that he, the way he developed cartoons, those that short show that he did at Cartoon at Hanna-Barbera / Cartoon Network, and then took briefly to Nickelodeon and made a couple of pretty huge hits the same way there. It's unfathomable to me that that's not the way everybody just develops cartoons now. Because I mean that the record, the number of hit shows that not only created the bedrock that was Cartoon Network, were all those shows, but they set up like pop culture from the animation side of it for decades. And that's amazing. And the fact that people don't just copy what Fred did is astounding to me. So I would ask him,
idiotic.
I would say like, I would ask him a lot of questions. How did you set this up? What was, you know, cause I remember I was there. I remember some of it, but you know, Two Stupid Dogs predated that. We were in the door making our show when he came up with the whole way he was going to bring all those people in and let them make their cartoons. And that was an amazing disruption, and it changed everything.
That it did. I mean, it changed your life, changed my life, changed millions of people's lives, both in the industry and just fans of the industry. So, you know, I like I said, I told you this, but I do this podcast to say thanks for you and thanks for everybody else that I've ever had on the show, because you guys, good, bad, or indifferent. I know I keep using the fucking term and it's getting annoying. I got to come up with something else. You know, I made so many friends over the shows and the cartoons that I watched growing up. I mean, you guys, I'm pretty sure you had it the same way. You were a fan of, you know, Scooby-Doo and the Looney Tunes. I'm pretty sure you sat around in the cafeteria when you were a kid talking, oh my God, you see what Bugs? And I got to do that with these two stupid dogs that you have right there in the back on that poster right there. I got to do it with Dexter and Powerpuff Girls and Cow and Chicken and all of these cartoons back here. Like I said, I made friends. I made some of those friends I don't talk to anymore. But a couple of those friends I still do talk to. And we talk about the cartoons. Now I get to share these with my kids. So you guys all collectively changed it, and we owe you guys all a debt of gratitude. I got a little choked up there, Donovan. I apologize. A debt of gratitude, because like I said, you guys are, what's that?
I'm just saying it goes both ways. I mean, you can make a cartoon, but if nobody watches it, like, does it even exist? You know what I mean? Like, you make everybody that makes cartoons, and you know, tries to make funny stuff or any, you know, any of this kind of stuff, music, cartoons, movies, whatever, you make it to get it in front of people and affect mm-hmm. people, connect to people. So there, it's a two-way street.
Yeah, thank you. The yin and the yang. Oh, thank you. You know, so as we start to kind of push off past this and get into Two Stupid Dogs, you said you started building this team of just like, you guys had some of the best artists, the best writers, and they would go on to help further and build and prop up Cartoon Network, you know, after your time had kind of ended there. But what were some of, like, when you're building a team, and you in specific for this one, I know you can't talk for everybody, but you in particular, like, are you just reaching out to friends you went to school with or somebody you might have worked in the industry with? How are you trying to find and build your roster of writers and artists?
Well, they, so, you know, they, I can't remember if in the beginning, you know, when they first actually brought me in, they hooked me up with somebody they had in house, who started doing a storyboard for a presentation piece we wanted to make. And I wasn't a huge fan of what they were doing. And at some point there, Larry got involved. But again, I was kind of arrogant. I didn't look at everybody who was there and even even think about like, oh, maybe I'll work with some of the people that are here. For me, it was all about coming in and building my own team. And one of the first things that the studio did, for whatever reason, I still don't really know why, they didn't want three stupid dog cartoons. For some reason, they thought that would just be too repetitive. And then I remember they asked me, can you come up with another cartoon to put in the middle? And honestly, I was like, well, I'm not going to just give you another, like a whole nother cartoon idea. Yeah. I kind of felt like they were trying to, you know, squeeze another thing out of me. So I was like, I loved Secret Squirrel when I was little. So I just remember thinking like, I'm just going to ask them if I can make new Secret Squirrel cartoons. And they were like, okay, like that's, I guess that's fine. And so the first thing I did, I said, all right, I got to hire somebody to like start working with me to figure that out and start drawing it and figure out what it's going to be. And I had gone to school with Paul Rudish, and he was a good friend at school. But he was also somebody that, I mean, Paul was a miracle from day one at school. I mean, we were 18 years old when we all showed up at school. Yeah. And Paul could draw like he was touched by, you know, by the cartoon angel. I mean, we were all just struggling to figure out, you know, what we liked and what we wanted to draw and just how to draw. And he was eons above us in terms of his ability. And his style, he had a style. Most of us, you show up at school, you don't have a style yet. You're basically, if you have a style, you're copying whatever you love the most.
Yeah.
But he had a unique, I mean, he was, anyway, so Paul was amazing. So I was still in touch with Paul. We'd only been out of school for a couple of years. So I called Paul and hired him, and we shared an office for a couple months. And he immediately, I was like, Secret Squirrel, like, and he'd seen it. He knew it, obviously. And it was Paul's idea to make it an all animal universe.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first thing. He was like, I want to draw everybody as animals. And I was like, bitching. Like if you draw. So I came up with the first story that we did, like, which was sort of just kind of a half-assed parody of Goldfinger. And so he started designing the world, and I started doing a rough storyboard of that pilot while I was also working on whatever this presentation piece was for Stupid Dogs. But Paul stayed at school for a year or two longer than I did. So Paul, like, I didn't overlap with McCracken,
mm-hmm.
or Rob Ronzetti or Gandhi. There was a bunch of people that Paul knew that I didn't know. And so Paul was like, you should hire Craig. You should hire. And so I started calling these people up and, saw their, and I mean, I had seen Craig's, we'd all seen No Neck Joe. And I think we'd all seen, what was Whoop Ass Girls at that time. So, but I didn't know Craig, like we weren't friends. But so I think Craig and Mike Moon were the next two people. And I knew Mike, he was a year or two younger than me, but we were at school at the same time. And he was another person that I thought was amazing. So I hired I hired Mike and Craig next. And then Craig knew people. And so basically I would just say, like, you know, they would talk about somebody that they thought was awesome. And I would call them up and meet them and look at their stuff if I hadn't seen any of their stuff. And that was, it kind of grew from there.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's how you build a team, right, man? It's all about who you know. And there was something that I had written down when we were talking about, you know, going back in time and if you'd say anything or change anything. You said there was a story that you like telling about Joe and Secret Squirrel. Would you mind telling that one?
Yeah, so... We had a full storyboard for our first Secret Squirrel cartoon. And I was like, I'm going to go pitch it to Joe Barbera and get his, you know, ask him what he thinks. You know, I'm going to get notes from Joe Barbera because he created it. I mean, to me, that was the thing. I mean, it wasn't our cartoon. We kind of, you know, we retooled it a little bit, but we were making it because we loved what they made. Mm-hmm. So we were sort of, caretakers of it. So to me, the first thing, once we had something we could show, was, why don't I go show it to Joe? And Joe had this office, like, it was really funny. So Joe's office was on the ground floor, actually not far from Fred's. And Bill's office was on the roof in this weird little penthouse they had built. But they couldn't have been farther apart from each other. But Joe and Bill's office was like all glass, and it was all sunlight and bright. Joe's office was like a bear's den, man. I mean, it was dark. It was all wood panel. It was crazy. I mean, it was like, I swear to God, it seemed huge too, by the way. I don't know how big it was, but I remember the first time I walked in there, it was like all like time and what year it was, everything just disappeared. It was like being in a casino in Vegas. It was just like, oh man, where am I? Like, is it, I don't know if it's like the 60s or the 50s or the 70s or like, because it was also, it was wall to wall art and toys and stuff that he'd made. Right? So it was just this amazing like place to go. So I had met him once or twice, but hadn't really spent a lot of time talking to him. But and for some reason, I didn't take anybody with me. It was just me and Joe. And I went in there with the storyboard, and I was like, I want to. And the crazy thing is, I mean, and I was nervous, right? I mean, this wasn't pitching to some, you know, executive somewhere. This was pitching to the guy that created the thing you're going to pitch to him.
Yeah.
So the first thing that happened, and this isn't fair because I don't remember how old he was at the time, but he was pretty old. So I'll tell the story. But the first thing is I came in and I don't know, you know, when I made the appointment to go see him, I'm sure I told him what I wanted to do, but they either didn't tell him or he didn't remember. So I told him like, you know, we're here, we're making a cartoon, and we're making more of your cartoon, Secret Squirrel. And the first thing he said to me was, we didn't make Secret Squirrel. And I was like, yeah, you did. You see that little stuffed animal on your wall over there? That's Secret Squirrel. This is your show, right? So I think it somehow came back to him. And so I pitched him the show, and it was, you know, and it was like the whole pitch. I was doing the voices and really like trying to sell it. And when it ended, all he did was, I don't have anything to use as a prop here. He picked up the plush stuffed animal of Secret Squirrel, and he said, "Oh, Secret, they've ruined you." And that was it. He didn't give me any notes. He didn't say like, "I think you should do this," or, you know, "Throw that out, add this." He just, I don't know if he hated it or if he just, it was just not from his time or whatever, but to me it was heartbreaking and hysterical at the same time. I didn't know how to, I was just like, all right, thanks.
Oh, so that's the second.
My defense is that might be why I didn't go back to him more often.
That's, I mean, the second.
If somebody smart had been there, you know, talking in my ear, I would have gone back and sort of chipped through that. And like asked, you know, have, you know, dug into how he works and how he thinks and how he created what he created, you know. But anyway, that, yeah, that was epic. And I remember going back upstairs to tell Paul and some of the other the team that was there. I was just like, you guys, he didn't love it. But here's, I mean, but that's the thing again. We didn't care. We just kept making, we were like, all right, well, he doesn't love it, but we're going to keep doing it because we love it.
That's awesome, man. So that's the second Joe Barbera story I've heard. The other one I had, Van Partible on, Johnny Bravo creator, right? He was talking about, because they did a Scooby, Johnny meets Scooby-Doo, or Scooby-Doo meets Johnny, whatever it was. He wanted to show what they were working on. He always called him Mr. B, he said. So he goes over there, and I can't remember, they said, you got to get Joe before breakfast or before lunch. You don't want to get him after. What happened is they ended up getting him after. So they're showing him everything, and he's just
Yeah, right.
So they look over, Van's doing the whole pitch, and it's been a couple years since I've listened to the Van episode, and I'm probably, you know, fucking forgetting some shit. But he woke up and he said, "You got the walk cycles correct for Shaggy," I think is what he said. So he was nodding off the entire time, looking at the Johnny Bravos thing, and then he honed in on the walk cycles. So Van knocked it out of the park, and he impressed Joe.
That's great.
Yeah, so I've enjoyed the two Barbera stories that I've got here. All right, man. So as we start to wind down, I'd be remiss to not ask you. It's been quite some time since I've went back and watched this show. I usually ask you guys like, hey, you know, what are, you know, a couple of your favorite episodes so we can talk about those. But if you had fun on this one, I figure we can set something up down the road and come back on, and maybe we'll bring a couple of those artists back on with you if you want to, and then we can delve into some of the episodes later.
Yeah. If you think there's more to mine, I'll as long as you want.
Oh, 100% there is. Like I said, this show is very important. There's not a lot of stuff out there about this show when it comes to, you know, anything. I mean, I don't think any of the Cartoon Network shows really had any art of books that's never really brought up. You know, you don't really see it. You might see something in like a rerun of, you know, an old show that was recorded or something like that. But you really got to search for Two Stupid Dogs a lot. Same thing with SWAT Cats. Now, when they bring you in for Two Stupid Dogs, and you said you wanted to be there, they were trying to just take your creation and do it in-house. Did you retain the rights to Two Stupid Dogs, or did you have to sign those away completely?
Sign away completely.
Now, if they don't do anything with them, like, so Sony has to do so many Spider-Man movies so often, or the rights revert back to Marvel, which is now Disney. Is that the same thing with cartoons, or once they own it, they own it?
I mean, all deals are different, but I'm pretty sure all those original deals, I mean, typically the deal, if a studio makes a deal to make cartoons or make, quite frankly, if it's not pre-existing, then they buy it, because
gotcha.
Why not control the whole thing? They're the first ones in. They're the first ones that are going to spend money. When you're the first one to take the risk on somebody's idea, typically you buy it. I mean, it changes when you. I mean, if McCracken goes and sells a show now, he's Craig McCracken. He's got, you know, whatever, so he can make different arrangements, but. When you're somebody that hasn't made multiple hits, or you're not a pre-existing piece of material, you sell it, and then part of the deal is you get to make it. So you negotiate the amount of creative control you can have, but yeah, no, the ownership of it's gone.
Was that hard to let go?
No, because it was always the plan. I mean, it was And it wasn't, you know, for me, the purpose of making the cartoons was, it was the first of a million things I was going to make, you know, like, so I didn't feel like, oh, I'm signing away my Mickey Mouse, you know, it was just, hey, I finally found somebody that's willing to spend money to look at these cartoons. And for me, it was. One, I loved cartoons. I wanted to make cartoons. And two, I knew I needed to make cartoons to get good enough to maybe then make more cartoons and then make movies. And then, you know, I mean, I wasn't crazy enough to think that I was, you know, 1 year out of school that I could just make a movie.
Yeah.
So for me, part of it, the reason why making cartoons for television was part of the plan was because, I mean, I was and have always been a big Spielberg fan, and Spielberg spent those years working on television at Universal for Duel and Jaws and onward from there. And even going back, you know, and I loved, I mean, to me, I was always a big classic Disney nerd, and that whole studio spent years making short cartoons before they made that leap to longer form. So to me, it was just like, oh, well, this is how you learn how to do it. So, yeah, signing it away, no, that wasn't hard.
Yeah, I've heard a term that you guys use quite often, and it's not so much about, you know, properties, but it's about, you know, they just say don't be too precious with your drawings, right? You know, you got to be able to punch on, punch down. You got to be able to be flexible. So I didn't know if that was a lot of that mentality, because being an outsider, just being a fan of what you guys do, you come up with something like Two Stupid Dogs. I'm like, fuck, dude, would that feel like giving away a child? Even though that's the whole process of you want to make these cartoons, is it like giving a piece of yourself away? And that kind of leads into the next question. But that's the way I was imagining. You're giving them a piece. They are letting you do what you want to do, which is create these cartoons, get them out there for people to see, and get better at your craft. The more reps you do, it's that 10,000 hour rule that Bruce Lee always talks about. The more you do it, the better you get. So I've always found that topic fascinating, about selling a show and giving that piece of somebody of you.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I you know, the funny thing is it's totally different now. I mean, if I were talking to a, you know, a 20 or 22 year old now that had a great idea, for a show, I would not say go pitch it around town. I would say, but beg, borrow, and steal whatever you need to make a 2, 3, 5, 7 minute cartoon.
Yeah.
Put it on YouTube, and then now it exists, you know, but back then, even though we had gone to school and technically we could make a cartoon from start to finish, we knew how to do it. It still, there was a certain amount of physical equipment you needed. It wasn't like it is now. I mean, people, you know, throw around the terms democratization of, you know, film and whatever. It's real. I mean, in 1991, to make a cartoon that you could put on the internet, which barely anybody was using at the time, did you ever, you must know who Mike and Spike are, the Sick and Twisted animation festivals. Yeah. That was really, like, that was kind of the pinnacle. If you made a short cartoon, getting it in Mike and Spike's show was it. So that's what you would have done back then. But there was a fixed cost just to buying film and sell paint, and you know what I mean, like, there wasn't any way to just sit at home and do it.
Yeah.
But now, that's what I tell everybody, and it's, you know, and my, you know, on in my quote unquote spare time, that's what I'm doing. I mean, it's like, you don't need those executives, you don't need their wallet to make something now, especially with a concept. I mean, you might need millions and millions of dollars to make, you know, a ton of episodes, but you can make one story and you don't need them. But then you had to have them. So it wasn't like some great sacrifice. It was a thrill. It was like, somebody bought my fucking show. Like, I'm going to make my show. I mean, I had people tell me, I remember that story I told you about Dindal breaking into my apartment to get my stuff. That gig that I was working on, there was a guy on that with me who was kind of he was youngish, but he was a veteran. He'd been around for a while. And I was talking all about, like, yeah, I'm going to make a cartoon at Hanna-Barbera. Like, they're going to buy it. And I remember one evening at dinner on that project, he looked at me. I mean, he looked me dead in the eye and said, "You really think this is going to happen? You really think you're going to actually make a TV show?" And I was like, "Yeah, like, why not?" And he was like, "It's impossible. It'll never happen." But I was too dumb to know that, so it happened. But so, yeah, I mean, in terms of the heartbreak of giving away your baby, it never even felt like that. It just felt like somebody was, you know, giving me a home for my baby. I didn't think of it as selling it away. I thought of it as, you know, I just hit a home run.
Boy, oh boy, did you hit a home run, man. You hit a fucking, I don't know shit about baseball. You hit a line drive, whatever, if we're talking basketball, we're talking sumo wrestling, I'm your guy. I don't know shit about baseball. What's that?
I don't know what the equivalent of a home run for sumo wrestling is, but I want to know now.
Oh, I mean, it depends. It depends on your style of sumo. You got pushers, thrusters. You got dudes that work on the mawashi, which is their belt. So it's a great sport to watch. I've been a fan, you know, since Street Fighter II, when I got to whoop my older sister's ass with E Honda. She actually, she would not let me use E Honda because of his, he hits you with the hand and he backs you up and shit, but she could use Chun-Li, and Chun-Li did the same thing, but she did it with kicks. She was very hypocritical, like most, older siblings are. So, but yeah, I've been a fan of sumo wrestling ever since then. But to wrap it up, I always wrap it up, you know, kind of the same way. But it's a fun way to like encapsulate your time with Two Stupid Dogs, with Cartoon Network, with Hanna-Barbera, and everything that you got to do. Before we get to that question, there's one I'd like to ask. Do you think you now, if you were given the opportunity, do you have any more stories that you would like to tell? Do you feel like you could tell one more to wrap it up of Two Stupid Dogs, or are you kind of that was a chapter?
You mean stories about making Two Stupid Dogs?
No. Like, if you were given the opportunity, would you want to tell one more story of Two Stupid Dogs?
The Dogs cartoon?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's 20 Stupid Dog cartoons in my head. All the like, yeah. You know. Yeah. There's. I mean, I love that it's still a little bit out there, and that there's still people that can see it. In the various ways they can see it, but we didn't make very many of them. There's tons more that somebody could make. I mean, I'm not. To me, it would be really fun to make another Stupid Dogs cartoon. It's not something that I'm like. I'm not going to Warner Brothers and saying like, "Come on, you gotta let me make more Stupid Dogs cartoons." But I mean, the whole point of that kind of cartoon is you can kind of keep doing it forever. Mm-hmm. Personalities and the conflict that's inherent in the two characters and the way they fit in the world, there's the number of stories you could tell doesn't end.
Yeah, right on, man. So we're gonna end it with this question. If you could summarize your experience with Two Stupid Dogs from the creation to the pitching to the making to the, you know, finale or ending it. If you could surmise that in one word, one phrase, one sentence, one paragraph, what would your time be like? What would you say about your time on Two Stupid Dogs?
Well, it's hard to encapsulate it into one little statement or certainly, I mean, one, it was just fun as hell. I mean, we got free reign of an animation studio. So it was fun to make those cartoons. The other thing is it imprinted on me the value of disrupting the status quo. I love and respect other things that I see in other areas of the world and music and whatever, whenever somebody is able to jump in and in some way radically disrupt what is kind of the status quo. Mm-hmm. And for us, I mean, you know, I've made a number of other things now, and some of it's more mainstream than others, but even in the mainstream stuff I do, I'm always looking for some way to disrupt, whether it's some stuck way that a studio has of doing something that hinders imagination or creativity, or whether it's storytelling that seems stuck. Everybody's kind of done it one way, and you're just looking for some other way to break those rules. That was what that place was about, man. I mean, and everybody just had a blast and were breaking rules. I mean, there's definitely, yeah, if you want to do more, there's some good like sidebar stories about kind of crazy shit that happened just because You mean, the other thing is, if you fill a studio at least partially with people that are under 30, or even under 25, they don't have families. They don't have homes that they own and have to take care of. They spend all their time there, and they work there, and they screw around there, and they sleep there. I mean, one of the things, I don't think I have it anymore, but for years I had a recording of a voicemail that Fred left me because he showed up in the morning and found me asleep in my car at like, 8 a.m. or something. And he called me and he knew he was going to leave me a voicemail because he knew I was in my car asleep. He called my office phone, which people had back then, and left me a message just saying like how great he thought it was that, his cartoon maker was working so hard that he was asleep, passed out in his car asleep at 8 o'clock in the morning in the parking lot of the studio. But that's what, there was a lot of stuff that happened because we were all just there. We had dreamt when we were little kids, everybody has a different moment where they woke up and said, I want to make cartoons. But that happened for everybody at some point when they were little. And then, either you went to school or you found your way there. And now you were doing it. You were living, it sounds cliche, but we were all living the dream.
Yeah, what a beautiful way to end it, man. I mean, I've gotten to hear some really, really cool stories from you and really, really cool stories from other folks that got to grace those walls and then grace our TV screens with things that started up here that went down your arms, whether you're right hand or left hand, and made it onto a cell, made it onto a Syntec, made it onto a tablet these days now. And we got to see it and we got to grow with it. We got to grow with you guys, man. So like I said, you'll never hear me say a disparaging word about any of you guys and gals that, like I said, created our childhoods, man. We're forever indebted to you and folks that worked on your shows and worked on other shows, man. If I could surmise, my experience with Two Stupid Dogs, it'd be peaceful, right? That was the only time that my brother and I weren't punching each other in the head and making my mom scream and yell at us. So, it was a very special time, especially when we were younger. We were very, very, I'm an older brother. He's a younger brother. So he had little brother energy. I had big brother energy. We were very combative, so this was something that like I said, we could just sit down, veg out and watch these two characters that we saw ourselves in, man. So thank you for spending a little bit of time with me tonight and thank you for everything you've done and you continue to do. I know you were what's that?
Thank you, Julian. It's great to have an opportunity to chat about it.
Oh, absolutely, man. The pleasure is all mine. So I know you said you were working on Gabby's Dollhouse over on Netflix. So you want to tell us a little bit about that before we sign off?
Yeah, it's just, it's exciting. It's been five. We produce it at DreamWorks, and it's on Netflix, and it's grown into a bona fide hit. It's a huge preschool show now. I'm trying to figure out if I can say this out loud.
If not, we can cut it out.
I won't say any numbers because that might get me in trouble, but I will say that Netflix has never ordered any series, much less an animation series, to the number of episodes that we're making.
Oh, right on, man. Congratulations.
It's pretty amazing. It's been magical. I mean, preschool is a whole nother thing to talk about, and it's a different way of kind of thinking about animation and cartoon storytelling. But it's been a blast. It's been, it's a really animated show, and like you say, I mean, when I was 22, I was fortunate enough to make a show that reached a ton of little kids, and now same thing. It's a gift to know that what you spend your days on is out there making people laugh and play and be able to sit quiet and not terrorize their mom. Yeah, it's a gift. I mean, that's I've learned to recognize and express gratitude for things over the years, and so I have an immense amount of gratitude for for that show and for the success that it has and that people love what we make.
Well, it's a beautiful way to end it, man. Well, he's been Donovan. I've been Julian. It's been a What's My Head podcast, and this has been another piece of your childhood. Good night.
Hey, guys. It's your resident cartoon junkie, Brandon Jones, here asking you to have a listen to my Animation Destination podcast. It's an animation celebration podcast, and it's full of all sorts of stuff about anime and cartoons and voice acting and all that sort of thing, and just a really all-around celebration of anything animated. So come on by and check it out. We've got fan episodes of your favorite animes to your most obscure cartoons on Netflix that no one's ever heard of, and just really love talking about it. You can subscribe to us on Spotify and iTunes and anywhere else you can get your podcasts from. So stop on by, subscribe, and stay tuned for the Animation Destination Podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. Before we go, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with the podcast today. I truly appreciate every download and listen we get. If you're liking what we're doing, drop us a 5-star rating, drop us a review, tell a friend, and I'll see you next week.